Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Force, have just issued communique number one.
A landing was made this morning on the coast of France for the liberation of Europe.
The people of Normandy are celebrating their liberation. The church bells are ringing.
We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island. Whatever the cost may be.
HMS Medusa.
Remembering a day that changed the world.
D-Day.
D-Day.
70 years on.
70 years on.
With Richard Hutchinson.
Chicago way. He had a boogie style that no one else could play. He was the top man at his craft. But then his number came up and he was gone with the draft. He's in the army now, a blowing reveille. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. They made him blow a bugle for his Uncle Sam. It really brought him down because he couldn't jam. The captain seemed to understand. Because the next day the cap went out and drafted a band. And now the company jumps when he plays reveille. He's the boogie-woogie bugle boy of Company B. A toot, a toot, a toot-de-la-da-toot. He blows it A to the bar. In boogie rhythm, he can't blow a note unless the bass and guitar is playing with him. He makes a company jump when he plays reveille. He's the boogie-woogie bugle boy of Company B. He was a boogie-woogie bugle boy of Company B. As a bzzz bee. And when he plays, he makes the company jump A to the bar. He's a boogie boogie bugle boy of Company B. Do 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 da da do da da do do. He blows it A to the bar. He can't blow a note if the bass and guitar isn't with him. And the company jumps when he plays reveille. He's a boogie boogie bugle boy of Company B.
Sleep with Boogie every night and wakes them up the same way in the early bright. They clap their hands and stamp their feet because they know how he plays when someone gives him a beat. He really breaks it up when he plays reveille. He's the Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy of Company B.
On a stormy night in June 1944, five beaches on the French coastline were quiet, waiting for an event that would change the course of the Second World War. Ships carrying soldiers, tanks, weapons, equipment, fuel and food were gathering in English ports along the coast from the Thames estuary to Falmouth. As the crucial time approached, bad weather moved in, and the invasion was delayed for a further day. Tens of thousands of soldiers in craft of all sizes fought off seasickness and waited for a signal from the Supreme Commander of the Allied Forces, General Dwight D. Eisenhower, to go. As the weather broke, that order was received, and 7,000 ships, boats and craft set off as part of Operation Neptune, the largest naval flotilla the world had ever seen. Ahead of the ships, Harbour Defence Motor Launch ML-1387 set her course directly towards a gap in the German minefield to mark a safe channel to Omaha Beach.
But we're the dawn.
Harbour Defence Motor Launch ML1387 is now named HMS Medusa and is part of the National Historic Fleet, representing the nation's maritime heritage. Alan Watson is her captain and chairman of the Medusa Trust.
The whole purpose of the HDML Harbour Defence Motor Launch was to guard harbours, act as an offshore screen and stop submarines coming in. As it turned out, the submarines didn't really turn up, apart from one at Scapa Flow, and so that role never came to pass. But it was found that it was such a seaworthy small ship, so heavily armed, that they were used for all sorts of other purposes. Used around UK waters for convoy escort, in virtually every other theatre of war, the ships made passage round to Australia, New Zealand, India, Pakistan, saw action there. They saw action in the Mediterranean. They were very, very quiet, and so they were very popular for agent landing. They did a lot of that in the Far East. And they're extremely seaworthy, so they had long periods at sea for convoy escort as well as offensive operations.
How many of them were built?
There were 480 built. They were built in batches of 10 at small boatyards, mainly around the UK, although some were built in America. And generally little boatyards that had just built private craft pre-war, so had the skills in wood. The ships were entirely built out of wood. Unlike their bigger sisters, they were craftsmen built from a set of drawings. Bigger sisters came as a big airfix kit and were put together. But these are all quite individual. Everyone's slightly different.
We'll be finding out very soon more about her role in D-Day and the D-Day landings. But what was her role before that?
D-Day was virtually her first task. She was launched October 1943, commissioned Christmas Day 1943. This was at Poole. She came from Poole to Portsmouth and then from Portsmouth down to Dartmouth, Dartmouth up to Scotland, and coastal forces all went to Scotland for initial crew training and working up. And at Falmouth, she had special equipment fitted for D-Day. So this was spring of 44. And it took some time to train the crew in this new equipment. It was highly secret electronics, but that was all fitted there. After that, then she came back in this direction. We're at Portsmouth at the moment. Very shortly afterwards, took part in Exercise Fabius 1, which was on 3rd of May 1944, the practice assault on Slapton Sands. Medusa formed part of the screen to prevent enemy incursion, interference with that plan. And then only a month after that, D-Day.
She wasn't that fast, but her endurance was a lot longer.
Yeah, this hull form is what's called a displacement hull, which means she sits in the water. It means that she's not particularly quick, but it also means that it doesn't need a lot of power to drive her along. Her maximum speed's 12 knots, but she's got something like 2,000 miles endurance on a full tank of fuel. She carries 1,500 gallons of diesel on board, and this was quite different to the motor torpedo boats and motor gunboats. They were short endurance, very high speed, typically 40 knots. At the time, high-speed diesels weren't available in the UK. Germans had them, but we didn't. The MTBs, MGBs, they were all petrol engines. And so they went to sea with 1,500 gallons of high-octane petrol on them, which must have been really popular amongst the crews.
Not the safest environment in a field of war.
Not at all. The tanks were self-sealing, which gave some protection. Yeah, a good shell hit on a fuel tank and it was game over. Diesel, on the other hand, is very difficult to set alight, but the flip side is it's very difficult to put out once it gets going. It wasn't too much fun sitting on top of 1,500 gallons of diesel in a small wooden boat packed with explosives as well.
400 of these vessels were built. How many of them still exist today?
There's very, very few left. We're standing on the last one that's as built, still operational and seagoing. If you go around the UK, you can find two or three up creeks as houseboats, barely recognisable, but we know where they are. There's a couple in New Zealand, still operational, but that's about it. And that number reduces radically each year. These were all built in the 1940s. They were built for a five-year operational life. 70 years on, then they're feeling their age. This one wouldn't be here if she hadn't had a lot of TLC and a fairly major rebuild some years ago.
Thank you. but leave your worries, leave them on the doorstep. Life's sweet. Just direct your feet to the sun, sunny side of the street. Hop, bottle, noodles, that bitter path. You know that happy tune is my step. Life's all right if you dig that beat. On the sun, sunny side of the street, used to walk in the shade with my blues on parade. What a drag, old man, getting stuck in the shade. Get hip, don't be afraid. Move it on over, kill yourself in the clover. Only hit for a sin, who cares? Rich as Rockefeller.
We're right up in what's described as the eyes of the ship, right up forward. This is where everybody comes to do their Titanic moment. Up here, there's the anchors, anchor windlass, a dinghy, and the forward armament, which is a 20mm Oerlikon. That's a very high rate of fire, heavy calibre machine gun. It fires quite a big shell, will empty a 60-round magazine in 8 seconds.
And just looking at it, it's on a grey stand with a huge metal plate here, which looks like it must be for protection.
This is to give a degree of protection to the gunners. Being a wooden ship, there aren't too many places on board where it's worth docking. This is one of the few that you have got a degree of protection here. The other place that's reasonably solid is between the two engines. Everything else is wood. Anything firing at you tends to come in one side and straight out the other.
Just looking back at the ship, it looks quite large from here. How large is she?
She's 72 feet long, 16 feet wide, normal working weight, 54 tonnes.
The renovations that have been carried out on the ship have been quite extensive, haven't they?
Essentially, we took her to pieces and put her back together again. It was the tough decision. Do you keep original material? Do you keep a working ship? We went for the latter, which meant that we had to replace quite a lot. And we reduced her to keel frames, major bulkheads, replanked the hull, relaid the decks, and then put everything back in again. She's now virtually all constructed out of teak, so she should last a good time.
What reaction do you get from the public when they first see her?
Absolutely amazed. The public love her. Wherever we take her to events, which is pretty much what we do with her, then she's massively popular. Great big queue forms. It's quite interesting over the years, then gradually it's different people that are showing the interest. If I go back some years, then mainly it was veterans that were coming. They'd been on these, and they sat here and sometimes told their story for the first time. Increasingly now we're seeing it's children and grandchildren that come, but they're all hugely interested.
And she's very important to the heritage of the country and for telling the story of D-Day.
Absolutely so. There's a register of historic ships in the country, and there's something like 2,000 ships on that register. Out of that register, there's 200 vessels that are designated the National Historic Fleet. They are the vessels that are really important to the nation's heritage. It takes no guessing that HMS Belfast, HMS Victory is on there. But there's only three vessels, warships, on that registry that are still seaworthy. And this is one of them.
And what's her role going to be on D-Day?
In the week leading up to D-Day, then we shall be over at the Portsmouth side. We're currently at Gosport. We're then going across to France, and we'll go to Ystrom, up the canal under Pegasus Bridge, which will be quite a moment, and right up to the top end of the canal. There's a number of events over there. Then we're planning to go along the D-Day beaches, possibly into the harbour at Aramanche, where she was, certainly stopping on the exact spot where she did her role 70 years before. We'll stop there for a few moments and pay our respects. And then we're planning to go to Cherbourg and then back across to the UK.
Can do miracles, just to wait and see. caught up in the reverie. Every word is a symphony. Won't you believe me? Sailing takes me away to where I've always heard it be.
I've come along to Southampton today, to Saxon Wharf, which is where Medusa is taken out of the water once a year to have her annual maintenance checks. And with me is Ian Harris, who's one of the engineers aboard HMS Medusa. How did you get involved with the vessel?
I got involved through one of my colleagues who I actually sailed deep sea with, Eddie Dewar, who's one of the other engineers. And he told me they were short of engineers down here. I little believed him at the time, but came down to see how I'd get along with the other people and got along well. So I've been here ever since.
It's a unique view we have of the vessel because she's out of the water and this is her annual checks taking place at the moment. But a lot of work went into her when she was renovated.
It certainly did. From what I gather from the other lads, they used to get rained on when they were sleeping in their bunks because the deck was so porous. And Eddie assures me that he could actually see through the engine room side walls, the wooden walls, and see the sea and the air outside, which I suppose is good. They could see when they were coming alongside, but technically not very good.
As an engineer, that must have been quite daunting for the guys at the time to think, we've got to put this back together.
I think they could actually see an awful lot of major work in front of them. You know, the fact that they were, shall we say, limping along, and they really needed to be, as we are now, fully functional.
What sort of challenges did they have at that time?
The main challenge, from what I gather, really, they were rebuilding the engines quite happily when they had a fire in the boatyard. That ran the white metal out of both engines, at which point they had to be taken away to Chatham and completely rebuilt. It also destroyed some of the other artefacts, shall we say. Luckily, not the frame of the boat.
We're standing in a dockyard surrounded by lots of very modern craft. This is obviously the oldest vessel here at the moment, and hand in hand with that, spares must be very difficult to get hold of.
Spares are interesting. Interesting enough, we actually get some of them off eBay. If you hunt around on eBay long enough, somebody will come up with some old bits that are lurking about in the background. It's the only way we'll get spares other than having them made.
How long did the restoration take?
I believe around the 5-year mark. With the fire, if it hadn't been for the fire, it would have been probably 3 years.
A vessel of this age, does it have maintenance books?
We do have some maintenance books, yes. Obviously, the main engine manuals, we've got copies of the originals. The main thing, really, whenever I've joined a ship before, is checking out the valving, what I need to open up to get her going. Then you start listening to the engines and see when you've got a difference in change, just like you would with your car. And if there's some strange rattling noise or a rattling noise has gone, go and investigate.
How wide-ranging is your responsibility aboard HMS Medusa?
Wide, I'd say. The engineer's responsible, obviously, for anything mechanical. So pumping up fresh water, taking on fuel, answering the engine room controls when whoever's on the bridge rings down full ahead, half astern, or whatever it is. If we're out doing a ocean passage, we'll probably be at the top of the hatch and we'll go down every few minutes and check.
How similar is she to other ships that you've worked aboard?
Not in the least. The old ships I used to work on was a New Zealand shipping company and P&O. They carried Doxfords, which were several times the weight of the ship on its own. These engines, by comparison, are little sewing machines, shall we say, but they're very nice.
And, of course, to commemorate D-Day, you're sailing to France soon. Looking forward to that.
Oh, I certainly am, yes. It'll be a lovely trip. It's down the canal between Ouistreham and Caen and going by Pegasus Bridge. I have seen it from the road before. It'll be a lovely little canal passage I've never done in the past.
And what sort of challenges await you for the sea part of that crossing?
Quite frankly, just keep the engines turning, really. We've checked them out as far as we're able. Yep, should be good.
And, of course, the veterans coming on board who no doubt will want to see the engine room.
They absolutely love it. One of the joys, I suppose, is that you get people come on here that haven't seen one of these craft in 60 years, and they're almost crying when they come on, you know, with the old smells from the engine room, the diesel, and the fact that it feels like it used to 60, 70 years ago as they remember it.
I'm at Saxon Wharf in Southampton, which is the dockyard where HMS Medusa is taken for her annual checks. And at the moment in front of me, she's out of the water, standing on a hard standing right by the edge of a channel here in Southampton. And with me is Ian Harris, who's one of the engineers. Ian, a lot of work's been going on in the past week or so.
It certainly has. We've renewed all the anti-fouling. We've renewed the cathodic protection. We've also done as much maintenance as we can while she's been out of the water.
This is a view that not many people will get of HMS Medusa. We're standing right underneath her at the moment by one of the propellers here. Solid brass propeller.
Bronze, in fact. So the previous one was de-zincified. So we've changed it for a spare one, luckily, off another HDML. And we've put some more protection on. So hopefully she should last another good few years.
And just looking up, she towers above us. The top part painted grey, and just where I'm touching at the moment, it's like copper sheeting that's been painted black with lots of nails nailed into it.
Yep, during the Second World War, she was actually down to the Mediterranean. And the ones that were due to go down to the Mediterranean got copper sheathing, which is in effect what actually saved the vessel for this time. If it hadn't been for that, marine worms would have eaten through, and the vessel would have been lost for all time. The copper sheathing was put in back on after the refit, and I believe it took one man several months to do. Effectively, it saves the ship. Unfortunately, copper sheathing also gets eaten away, hence the reason also we have the cathodic protection on. That suffers rather than the hull. So hopefully she's good for another 60 years.
Now, moving on down, just walking along down her hull here, I understand also that the opportunity was taken to put some very modern equipment on board her during the recent maintenance.
Yes, absolutely, yes. A new echo sound has been fitted. It will provide a good picture of the bottom, radar coverage, everything you can think of, really. It is actually state-of-the-art. Medusa in 44 had state-of-the-art navigation equipment for her role on the D-Day beaches. She now actually has equivalent state-of-the-art navigation fitted as well.
And just moving further along the hull here to the very bow of the boat, I noticed that there's been quite a lot of paintwork been going on as well.
Yep, absolutely. The whole lower hull has been completely repainted. Obviously, the copper sheathing is covered in black anti-fouling, and the grey band above it has been completely repainted, ready for our trip over to France in a few weeks' time.
I've come inside Medusa to where a lot of work is going on at the moment with annual maintenance, and with me is Laura Pankhurst, who's one of the engineers aboard. Laura, how did you get involved with HMS Medusa?
Well, I saw Medusa down at the Southampton Boat Show, so we've got to have a look round, really interested. Found out they needed volunteers, because I'm currently in college studying marine engineering, and I thought it'd be a very good opportunity to get some proper experience.
A lot of people have learnt their skills and trained aboard her because a lot of shipwrights were involved in the rebuild, and that seems to be continuing with yourself learning marine engineering.
Yeah, I think that's about right. It's very different to college because college you've got a lot of space for like an engine. You can walk around, but here it's more realistic. It's a case of you've got small space and that's it. That's the space you've got to do stuff.
It's pretty compact, isn't it?
Yeah, very. I've whacked my head a couple of times, but it's nothing too bad.
What's it like working in the engine room when she's under sail?
Noisy. It's very noisy. I've occasionally been told off for shouting when I get home, but it just becomes natural.
Working on these engines, it's almost working on a piece of history. Do you notice that when you're aboard?
Yes, I have. There's no like electrical shortcuts. In some ways, I can appreciate them a lot more, and a lot of the work that older engineers who used to you're bored, I can appreciate all their work a lot more.
High and dry, but you know, so gonna shine on everything you do. The sky's so blue. The sun's gonna shine on everything you do. Gonna shine on everything you do. The sky's so blue. The sun's gonna shine on everything you do. Don't know why it's so blue. The sun's gonna shine on everything you do. And the sky's so gonna shine on everything.
I've driven about 2 miles north of Portsmouth to one of the key locations that was involved in the planning for D-Day. And with me is Matthew Wood, who is one of the guardians of the map at Southwark House. Matthew, what was this building in front of us used for?
Well, originally it was used by Admiral Ramsay as the Allied Naval Command Expeditionary Force headquarters. But on the 17th of May, Scheiff, the supreme headquarters of the Allied Expeditionary Force, took it over, and this is where they planned the final elements of Operation Neptune and the D-Day invasion.
It's a very impressive manor house. It's 3 stories tall, painted white with 4 pillars at the front and a very imposing doorway. 70 years ago today, on this very place, people have been coming and going through that door, 40, 50 people working inside. It was a real hive of activity in the lead-up.
This was really, and it was described later by one admiral in the Royal Navy, as the pinpoint of the invasion. So the decision to go had to be made. Everything rested on what the men in Southwark House decided they were going to do.
Just walking in through the main doors, we go into the reception area. It's immediately like stepping back in time.
Yes, that's right. Well, the house is quite an old Edwardian building. It's actually the third building that was built on this site.
Were the generals living in the house at the time?
They were not, no. They never stayed in the house itself. The closest general would have been General Eisenhower, the Supreme Commander. He actually stayed roughly about 2/3 of a mile down the road in an area of woodland known as Sawyer's Wood. He preferred to stay with his staff in his caravan. He called it his travelling circus. Montgomery, General Montgomery, stayed in Broomfield House, which is about 2 miles up the road, slightly better accommodation. But it was thought that if the Luftwaffe got lucky, and it would be very lucky, one bomb would have wiped out all of the Scheiff commanders. It would have been a disaster for the Allies.
Moving along the corridor and into one of the rooms off to the left, it says above the door Eisenhower. How important was this room?
This room was Eisenhower's office in 1944. It was the library for the house. It would have been bigot level clearance, and that was the highest restricted clearance of the entire war. For a period, not even the king was bigot level cleared. So that just shows you the men in this room were making the real decisions. Eisenhower, in this room, received the weather briefs from a group captain, Stagg, who was actually an academic from the Met Office. He was the man who could tell Eisenhower what the weather would be doing on the 5th, 6th of June. So in this room is actually where Eisenhower made the decision at 4:15 in the morning on the 5th of June. Just behind us as we're talking, in between two of the windows, there was a sofa, and he sat there literally with his chin never left his chest. It was literally weighing him down, that decision. And finally he says, OK, let's go. And that launches the entire invasion. So this very room is where it all started.
So next door, the famous map room. But 70 years ago, this was the most important room in the world.
That's right, this was the epicentre. If people knew that Eisenhower was here, the eyes of the world would be watching to see what he decided in this room. It doesn't have the map or quite the impact of the map room, but it is, if you think what actually happened in here and the words he spoke in this room, it's hugely important to D-Day and the operation that followed.
We've just walked through a very large door, and in front of me now, the whole of the far wall is filled with a giant map.
This is the D-Day map. So this is Eisenhower's map, or Scheiff's map. It's made, or it was made, by Chad Valley. So the Allies commissioned Chad Valley to make this map, which seems a little strange. a toy maker's very famous for wooden toys and jigsaws. That's essentially what the map is. It's one huge jigsaw. So it takes up the entire wall, But if you take a closer look, you can see the joins, the gaps, where smaller squares have been slotted together to create this ginormous map. They were convinced the Germans were everywhere. The Allies thought they had what was known as the fifth column. So Germans in every pub, every bus, just listening to your conversations. They were just waiting, as far as we thought, for this map to be made. So places like the Ordnance Survey or the Imperial Mapping Agency, surely there'd be a German spy in there just waiting for this map to be made. But why would they have one in a toy maker's? That was the thinking.
What would this room have looked like 70 years ago? What would have been the layout in here?
It would have been very different to today. Back in 1944, most of the space would have been taken up by two large wooden tables. On those tables, we would have had far more tactical maps of the beach area. So the western sector, the US sector, and the eastern sector, British and Canadian. On those maps, there's far more scope to do a lot more tactical planning. So they would have taken up the majority of the space. Connected to those desks, you would have had telephones that would have been connected to headquarters all over the country. Every single inch of space you can see on the walls all around you would have had maps of some description. So the D-Day map that's here is really the centerpiece, but every map that could give the Allies an edge, intelligence, anything that would help them when they get over to Normandy would have been plastered all over these walls.
And just moving up towards the map, having a quick look here, the thing you notice are the channels marked in red lines and then the green lines through the minefields.
The red lines, originally in 44, they would have been ribbons, they're now painted wood. They were swept convoy routes. For D-Day itself, the assault divisions, the roughly 160,000 men, would have been just based on the south coast. We're looking at roughly 7,000 ships, all in that tiny space, jostling for position. So it was a traffic nightmare for the Royal Navy and the US Navy. After they get to the staging area of Point Z, they then make their way down, and just before they get to a German minefield off the coast of France, they separate into their task forces, and we have five task forces, one for each beach. They would take the initial of each beach that they're sending troops to. So, for example, Task Force O goes to Omaha Beach.
And that's where HMS Medusa would have been sat, marking the start of that safe passage.
That's correct, yes. So the initial task for the naval powers was to get through the German minefield. On the map itself, there's a long silver stretch right through the middle of the English Channel. That's the German minefield. They've planted millions and millions of mines around the French coast. Roughly about 297 minesweepers are making their way through that minefield, creating 10 channels that the rest of that 7,000-strong force will come through.
So months and months of planning went into this, but this is where the final operation was masterminded.
That's right. You could arguably say years of planning. It's said, if you wanted to go all the way back to Dunkirk even, as soon as the British Expeditionary Force get back on English soil, Churchill is saying, make plans to go back over. So Southwark House is where they give the go for Operation Neptune.
And three short words signaled that.
Okay, let's go.
Goodbye. Wish me luck as you wave me 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 goodbye. HMS Medusa.
Remembering a day that changed the world.
D-Day, 70 years on.
Alan, we're now down in the engine room getting ready to sail. Some very large engines down here.
Yeah, the main engines, which are original to the ship, in fact one of them's older than the ship, Gardner 8L3 diesels, and that means they're 8 cylinders each. Each cylinder's 3 litres. They weigh 3.5 tonnes each. They're pretty massive. They'll push the ship along at 12 knots flat out, but we normally steam at about 10. Very, very low revolutions. A modern diesel engine might be running at 4,000 or 5,000 RPM. These run at 900, absolutely flat out.
And you were saying to me she was built for endurance.
Yes, that's right. Originally, we carried nearly 2,000 gallons of diesel. We consume about 8 gallons an hour when we're at sea, so it gives her massive endurance. These ships regularly did passage from here to Gibraltar, Gibraltar to Cape Town. Very long sea passages.
We've stepped down sort of about 2 levels below the main deck, below the bridge. How many people are working in here when we get underway?
Normally 2. There's 2 engineers on board. In the Navy days, one would have been a petty officer and one a stoker. We're quite lucky these days. We've got 2 ex-merchant Navy chiefs. I'm never quite sure who's in charge, one of the two. But this is very much their domain. For manoeuvring, then, quite often we'll have somebody on each engine. Where we are at the moment, we're at the control position. And there's a gear lever for each engine and a throttle lever for each engine. For a command for slow ahead, for instance, then the gear lever has to be put from the stop to the slow ahead position, which requires both hands and a bit of weight. Then the throttle open to give the correct revolutions. The engineers have to be pretty awake and watching the telegraph repeaters down here. Missing a command is really not good.
How tight is it when you come into the harbour or into a marina like this? Because you need to move backwards and forwards pretty quickly.
Ever so tight. Where we are at the moment, we're at the end of a small dock. There's about 5 feet after the vessel before another vessel, and about 10 feet before the end of the dock. It's not a lot of space at all, the tight turn to get in here. Unlike a modern craft where you can have one hand on the wheel and the other on the throttles and just make it all happen, you have to really think ahead on this. There's about a 20-second delay between asking for something and it happening.
you have to do the manoeuvring with a minimum number of engine movements.
In front of me there's a metal gangway and the two engines either side, and they're very large grey engines with about 7 or 8 cylinders in a line on each one, and some lag pipe that goes up to what looks like the exhaust. It must have been a very noisy environment.
Again, not as bad as a modern diesel because of the low revolutions. A modern diesel that's operating at high revolutions will have a turbocharger on it and they make a nasty screaming noise. These things just thump away. Now, we've measured the sound levels down here recently, and at normal cruising revolutions we're only just over the limit where you need to wear rear defenders, so it's not bad compared to a modern engine room.
When they were sailing for D-Day, how many engineers would they have had on board?
There were 4 then. She had a double crew, just to make sure that they'd got the endurance and really to cover any casualties. She was carrying 22 people for D-Day. Question to the captain afterwards was, where did they all sleep? And his answer was, I have absolutely no idea, I didn't leave the bridge.
Would they have been able to carry out running repairs while they were at sea, or was it purely to interpret the signals coming from the bridge?
It's possible to do some repair work. In fact, we have over the lifetime of the vessel. The expectation of the engineers was that they would keep the vessel moving no matter what. Obviously, if it's major damage, they can't do anything about it. That was the mantra, keep the vessel floating, keep it moving, keep it fighting.
Just in front of us, I can see the telegraph there, which is marked, obviously, full, half, slow. I guess that would be the one thing they'd be keeping their eye on throughout the whole voyage.
When we're manoeuvring in tight space, then there's an engineer sat by each of the two engine gearboxes. The telegraphs are slightly outboard, so one's looking slightly to his right, one slightly to his left, and they watch an engine each. If it's slightly less tight, there'll be a single engineer down here, and you can recognise our engineers in that their eyeballs have moved round to the side of their head, you know, a bit like a flatfish.
How would they respond to the bridge?
There is no sort of feedback from here directly, but from the bridge you can hear the engine note change, you know that you've got what you want. Oddly enough, you can, from the bridge, hear a lot of what's being said and what's happening down the engine room. I've just given away a secret. The engineers don't know that, but I can hear them talking to each other. So you've got a pretty good sense from up there as to what's happening. And if you don't get what you want, then you hit the bell and wake them up.
So it was a very close ship. The working environment on here must have been at times very friendly.
I think very much so. The thing we've discovered on here is that you can only work this ship by teamwork. The way we work the ship is pretty much the way the Navy did. Not because we're trying to do reenactment, that's not our thing at all, but actually it's the only way you can work the ship, is the way that she was designed to be worked. As skipper on the bridge, then I have to trust the helmsman to do what I ask, I have to trust the engine room to come up with the engine commands that are asked for, I have to trust the navigator because I can't see the chart table. We work as a team, and it's that trust that makes the ship go.
You've got a long voyage ahead of you because you're going to be sailing to France. How difficult is that going to be?
Quite challenging. None of us are in the first flush of youth. Can be quite tiring. The main challenge will make sure everybody gets adequate rest and is quite fresh. 2 years ago we did passage from Portsmouth and went round to London for the Jubilee pageant, which was 500 mile round trip. That went extremely well. This one will be a bit of a longer leg going across the channel. I suspect we'll all end up tired but happy by the time we get over the other side.
And quite an emotional trip as well at times.
Very much so. One of the things we're planning on doing on that trip is passing over the exact spot at the entrance to number 4 channel, just off Omaha Beach, that Medusa marked 70 years ago. We'll stop for a few moments and give thought to those that went there before us.
This is good. Digital radio, FM and satellite TV in the UK.
Online and on air around the world.
This is the Forces Station.
BFBS.
HMS Medusa.
Remembering a day that changed the world.
D-Day.
D-Day.
70 years on.
70 years on.
With Richard Hutchinson.
Think so little of me.
I'm standing on South Sea Beach with Andrew Whitmarsh, who is the curator at the D-Day Museum here in Portsmouth. And in front of me, looking over towards the Isle of Wight, it's pretty foggy today, and you can just about make out the island. A couple of sea forts in the middle, and just the odd yacht going backwards and forwards, and the Isle of Wight ferry. But back in 1944, on the 5th of June, it would have been a very different picture, wouldn't it?
Yeah, so in the days building up to D-Day, there are a huge number of ships and landing craft out in the Solent, anchored out there and waiting to go over to Normandy. As well as all the ships and the landing craft actually in the Solent, all the little harbours round about were also stacked full of ships and landing craft too.
And overnight, they completely disappeared.
Yeah, so some people who lived quite near the seafront in Southsea talk about waking up that morning, the morning of the 6th of June, looking out over the Solent, and whilst they were used to seeing all of these ships stretching out almost, the thing that people often say is that it looked like you could cross to the Isle of Wight going from ship to ship. So they woke up on the morning of the 6th of June, and suddenly all of the ships had gone, and that was, for those people, that was when they knew that D-Day had come.
And for people living here in Portsmouth, it was a very difficult time because there were lots of no-go areas.
Yeah, I'm quite far ahead of D-Day. You had to have a special permit in addition to your normal identity card if you wanted to come down into this area of Southsea. So people who lived here, or people who had what was judged to be a good reason to work down here, were given an additional pass, so you couldn't, not anyone could just walk down to where we are now on the coast and look at the beach.
One thing we haven't talked about is the lead-up and the preparations in a big way, because there were some exercises, like Exercise Fabius and Exercise Tiger.
Yeah, so for the preparations for D-Day were very long and thorough, because landing troops on an enemy-occupied or enemy-defended beach is a very difficult thing, and also it involves all the different services working together, which sometimes causes problems. There was lots of practices that went into this, and they started off on quite a small scale, so people would be trained to operate a landing craft, or simply to land, soldiers say, would be trained to land from a landing craft onto a beach. And those, just by themselves, those are things that needed lots of practice. Then also the practice were built up on bigger and bigger scale until you had exercises like Exercise Fabius, which was a whole series of landings in early May 1944, or Exercise Tiger at the end of April. Almost complete rehearsals for sections of D-Day. So you had large numbers of thousands of troops taking part, landing on the beaches, the warships firing their guns at targets ashore sometimes. The Air Force is also involved. So these exercises were great training, but they also were a test of whether all the different services were working together effectively and efficiently as they had to be on D-Day. And sometimes things were found where it wasn't all going smoothly, and so things were ironed out before D-Day itself.
And of course, one of the key things that was involved in D-Day were the Mulberry Harbours, which would have needed to have been taken over from this point as well.
So the Mulberry Harbours were artificial harbours that were created by the Allies because it was much faster to land troops and equipment at a port of some kind than onto a beach. But the Germans knew this too, so they would have been defending the existing ports in Normandy. So the solution was to create these artificial harbours, the Mulberry Harbours, that were built in pieces along the coast of the UK, taken over to Normandy after D-Day, and then rapidly assembled so they could be used. And parts of them were made in this area, in Gosport, in Portsmouth Dockyard and on Hayling Island. And in fact, just off the coast of Hayling Island, still today you can see a section of one of the what were known as the Phoenix caissons, which was kind of out of breakwater for the harbour, basically a massive concrete structure, and still one of these there today that you can still see.
Thank you.
fishing boats sail past the shore. No singing, Mayday anymore. The sun is shining, the water's clear. Just you and I walk along the pier.
HMS Medusa played a key role during the D-Day landings. Heading into the chart room, with the invasion plans laid out on the table, her current captain, Alan Watson, outlined the ship's involvement on the day.
It was absolutely crucial. If she had got her task wrong, then the outcome of D-Day could have been quite different. Essentially, what the British side were trying to do was convince the Germans that the landing was going to take place in the Calais area, and not the Normandy beaches at all. In fact, some of Medusa's sisters helped take part in that deception, worked with 617 Squadron, the Dambusters, to do so. The Germans had laid a minefield barrier down the channel, starting really from Dover and going down almost to Cherbourg. For the invasion to take place, then channels had to be cut through this minefield. Now, that could only be done at the last moment, otherwise it would really give the game away. And so it could only be done the night before D-Day, and that in turn meant that it had to be a very, very narrow channel, only a couple of hundred yards wide. So what was done was pre-D-Day, there were some ultrasonic markers laid on the seabed. They marked the position that would be an entrance through the minefield. Medusa's task was to be on that position at H-13, which is the night before D-Day, the evening of the 5th of June, and go to a precise location, sit on that location, and then the minesweepers came out and homed in on Medusa, started from her location, and then went ahead and cut a very narrow channel through the minefield. There was two channels for each of the invasion beaches. Medusa was Omaha Beach, and she was the second channel for Omaha Beach. So counting from the west, that was channel number four. She then had to stay on location all the way through the night before D-Day and all the way through D-Day itself to act as the marker to the entrance to the minefield. Now, the weather was absolutely appalling. It must have been extremely difficult to hold position. It must have been really unpleasant on board, but she had to stay there no matter what. And if she was off position by 100 yards, then the consequence of that could be that the invasion fleet would have gone into a minefield rather than a cleared channel. It was a pretty crucial role.
Planning for the invasion obviously was something that would have taken many months to build up. And in front of us at the moment on the chart table here, you've got a series of maps and plans which are marked Neptune Plan 1A and Neptune Plan 4. And on it marked a lot of the information which must have come from intelligence gathered from the German side.
Yes, there was an enormous amount of planning and preparation. It's a phenomenal exercise. I mean, it's easy to think that D-Day was just a mass scramble of 7,000 boats across to the other side. Well, it wasn't. It was all carefully planned. But the starting point was establishing what defences the Germans had. Every weapon was accounted for on the other side. Its ranges and arcs of fire were accounted for. It was pretty important for D-Day as well to know what the beach defences were and what the beach composition was, because you wanted to drive lorries up it. And so there was quite a lot of activity going across to the German beaches and taking sand samples, for instance, measuring the obstacles, planning all those, sorting out where the minefields were. From that, the invasion plan could be drawn up.
It wasn't the best weather. There was a full moon the night of the invasion. I wonder what it would have been like for the captain sitting out there, knowing that he was on the edge of a German mine barrier and marking the key to the invasion.
It must have been quite something, bearing in mind that the captain was only in his mid-20s. A very young man, most of the crew were young as well, a huge responsibility which he carried off. It was interesting to hear him speak of it some years later.
They had to find their way past me to the beaches, and I had to continue to mark the position while the invading escort forces led by the Belfast, the battle cruiser, and I informed them that we were in the right position, and so they were in the right position to continue with it.
He said that he didn't shift from the bridge the entire time. The little wooden seat up there, and he must have spent the night on that. I've been at sea on this in bad weather, and I know how uncomfortable it was, but nobody was trying to shoot at me. At that dimension, and the obligation, it was a phenomenal task, and quite amazing that somebody of that age could carry that off.
We know that the Germans weren't expecting an invasion that night because of the state of the sea and because of the weather. How bad was it out there?
It was quite bad. Weather conditions, they weren't quite gale force, but it wasn't much below that. The D-Day had already been postponed by one day, so this vessel would have sailed and then gone back again and then sailed again. The expectation at D-Day was that there was going to be a little weather window, as it's described. It would have got better for a little while before it got worse again. So she would have sailed while the weather was improving, had the benefit of that weather window, and then the benefit of it getting worse again. This vessel's only 72 feet long, 60 tons of her. The designer notes that he designed his vessels for the purpose, not for the crew. She's an extremely lively vessel. We're alongside in a sheltered dock at the moment, and you can feel her moving quite a lot beneath us. Out and about, well, I've been on her when she's rolled through a 90-degree arc in 3 seconds. It's an experience.
If she's rolling at 90 degrees, how stable actually is she?
Stability is an odd thing when you're describing a vessel. Stability doesn't mean that she stays level. Stability is all about how keen she is to get upright. In that context, she is exceptionally stable. She's desperate to get back onto an even keel, which means that she does so very quickly and overshoots the other way. So she's actually got more stability than she needs. A little less would be quite handy at times.
She was quite heavily armed for a vessel of this size, but on D-Day she was well within the range of the German guns.
Yeah, the Germans had got very heavy guns along the Cherbourg Peninsula. We've got the arcs of fire and the ranges, and she was well within that. We're talking very, very large projectiles, and it wouldn't have taken much more than a near miss to finish her off. Part of her instruction, really, apart from stay on that location, was don't get caught. She was carrying very, very secret electronics, which was used for the very first time at D-Day. That must not fall into enemy hands. So as well as the ammunition and everything else on board, then she had demolition charges on board.
An ominous grey box on the desk in front of you. What would that piece of kit have done?
Yeah, we have a little grey box here, which is described as Admiralty Pattern W8376, box for one detonator. That was the detonator for the scuttling charges she carried on board. So if there was any prospect of capture, then somebody would have had the task of setting that off and reducing her to matchsticks.
Underneath the lantern by the barricade, darling, I remember remember the way you used to wait. 'Twas there that you whispered tenderly that you loved me, you'd always be my lily of the lamplight, my own Lily Marlene. Orders came for sailing somewhere over there. All confined to barracks was more than I could bear. I knew you were waiting in the street. I heard your feet, but could not meet. My lily of the lamplight, my own Lily Marlene. Behind the line, even though we're parted, your lips are close to mine. You wait where that lantern softly gleams. Your sweet face seems to hold my dreams, my lily.
Brian Holmes is HMS Medusa's coxswain.
Basically, I steer the ship in and out of harbour, anywhere it's a little bit awkward, making sure there's enough guys on the wheel when required.
Do you come from a naval background?
I started off, I was in the Navy. I was an arts officer. I've worked around warships, fitting equipment, that sort of thing, for the rest of the time.
You were telling me that just yesterday there was a 90-year-old veteran who came aboard.
We had this guy, he'd been on about three or four D-type murder torpedo boats and finished the war out in the Far East on murder launches. It's absolutely surprising when you see them that the guy's 90, the family's wheeling down the pier in a wheelchair, and he sees the boat, he's got a sudden desire to get on board. And so many times we've seen it, he'll just stand up, he'll climb four steps, step across, climb on the bridge, he's happy, he's back 60, 70 years.
And of course, in the next few days, a very important voyage coming up for you.
Yes, another cross-channel trip. There comes a time when you've got to look at the weather. It happened on the 50th to us, when we took her across. We were storm-bound in Poole, and we got the absolute classic D-Day weather window of about 12 hours when we could actually make it. And we did, and there was a sudden change from a totally depressed crew of the night before. All of a sudden we got the go, and then people were running round getting us away from the pier.
And she's done her time in bad weather, because 70 years ago she was out there in those waves.
Oh yes, yeah, I mean, if you think about it, she marked one of the two approach channels, had to stay on the same spot for 36 hours, something that was about a westerly force 5 going on a 6. It's the worst time for us when we're actually stood still, because the boat's got no motion on it, so she just rolls and pitches around a little bit. You get really upset about it after a while.
I've just come below decks on HMS Medusa, and with me is David Carter, a member of the crew. And there's a special connection to this ship for you, a family connection.
Yes, my father was a captain of another HDML, which was HMS Meda. My father was killed in action in the Mediterranean. I didn't know the boat had survived. I've made contact with the then owner of my father's boat, and I've been out to sail on it in Gibraltar.
How similar is Medusa to your father's boat?
Identical. Medusa has been restored to 1943 condition, and it's identical to the photographs that I have of my father's boat. When Medusa was being rebuilt a few years ago, they used some of the photographs I'd got, which my father had taken, to get things aligned properly. For example, machine guns on the bridge.
How important is it that when the veterans and the members of the public come on board, that they see the ship in the condition that it was in during the 1940s?
They're quite so horrified at the really cramped conditions. And when you explain to them, well, people lived on this for some months and months at a time, they can't comprehend it. The Royal Navy take an interest in this boat, and when they have training courses for new officers, they borrow Medusa and we take them out to experience what it was like.
HMS Medusa.
Remembering a day that changed the world.
D-Day.
D-Day.
70 years on.
70 years on.
With Richard Hutchinson.
Thank you.
It's been a very early start for the crew of HMS Medusa. It's the 2nd of June and we've just sailed from Gosport to the Portsmouth Historic Dockyard. And tying up alongside to welcome some very special guests aboard, veterans from D-Day 70 years ago will be coming aboard to see the ship. With me now is Roy Blowers. Roy, how were you involved in the D-Day landings?
Well, we took the first lot of troops in. We were in a sort of support boat. We had sort of 2.5 machine guns and 4 Lewis guns in a well, and we went in just ahead of the troops. Anything that moved on the beach got shot up. Of course, they kept themselves well hidden until the landing craft came in with the troops, and as soon as they dropped the ramps, of course, they poked their heads above and fired on the troops in the carriers. And that's when we got a sight of them, and then when we could wipe them out then.
Which beach landing were you involved in?
I landed on Gold Beach, just on the left-hand side of Arromage. I assume it was Gold Beach, because once we were dropped from our boat, we had a parent boat, we were dropped into the sea, and as soon as we dropped in the sea, we saw land, and our coxswain just headed for it, so we assumed that was we were on the right beach.
We've been finding out quite a lot about the conditions aboard the boats at that time. What was it like being at sea?
Well, we were okay because we were just an ordinary boat and we could ride the waves, but the guys in the troop carriers were flat-bottom boats. I mean, we saw them each side. There was the wave. They were going down in the trough and the waves were bouncing right up and they must have got wet through. And they were dropped so far out as well that they must have been seasick, most of them, I should think.
We hear about the numbers, 7,000 boats. Was it obvious it was that big a landing?
Well, you honestly would not believe it unless you were there. Everywhere you looked, there were boats coming in, all different sizes and shapes, all churning. And the smells, you had the smell of the cordite, the naval ships that were bombarding the shore, the shells were whoosh over your head, and there was so much noise. And apart from that, the air was filled with aeroplanes as well. You know, you couldn't see the skies for planes.
Because, of course, you had to wait for a break in the weather, and that meant that it was delayed by 24 hours.
Well, it was delayed 24 hours, but quite frankly, it wasn't much better after the 24 hours. We were lucky because we were on the leeward side of the ship, and we were on davits dropped into the sea. So we were really lucky. But the people on the other side, of course, they had big troughs of waves, what, 7, 8, 10 feet high, dropped in, but it was rough going into the beach.
How much did you know about what would be happening once you went ashore? How well briefed were you by the officers?
Well, we weren't, in actual fact. We were just a support craft, and I was surprised because once we hit the beach, we hadn't got any other orders. So we just joined in here and there until we were recalled. Then we were sent back to England after about 4 days. We were given a quick treatment on Lloyd carriers with anti-tank guns, a crash course. Then we sent back. Then we landed on Mulberry, and then we went through France, Belgium, Holland, Germany, and we took over the docks at Wilhelmshaven.
When you landed on the beach, what was your objective?
To get off the beach. We beached our boat because it was like a gunboat then, and we could spray anywhere, anything we saw we could fire at. But once, of course, the troops came ashore, that was our job done, up to a point. But, of course, the landing craft, they daren't go right up onto the beach because they had to get back and bring more troops back. So some of them dropped the troops off in fairly deep water. And if it was too deep, they just drowned. Our instructions where we were when we were dropped in the sea, do not pick up survivors, don't stop for anybody, just go straight in. Well, there were the orders. But it was a fantastic sight. Everywhere you looked, there was boats, all different shapes and sizes and noises and smells. You know, you got the smell of the cordite and diesel and petrol engines. Absolutely fantastic.
You're here today with a lot of other veterans. There are a lot of veterans coming aboard. What does it feel like to be back and this time of commemorations?
Well, it was a fantastic, really, meeting the old guys. I've met one or two that was in my regiment. I was in the Royal Marines. And meeting the Americans as well, that was a big surprise to see them here. Because we used to go back and get their rations because ours was rubbish, but they used to have cigarettes and toffees and all that sort of thing. So we used to send a guy back, get some rations off the Yanks, you know.
And you're going back to Normandy, you're going back to the beaches. What are your thoughts at this time as you're about to revisit that place?
Well, I know when I go around and have a look at all the graves of all the people that are buried there, there's always a tear come in my eyes because you look at them and you think to yourself, oh, here's a guy, 18, he's had no life. Here's another guy, 46, but married, children, gone. And I look back now and I think to myself, I wonder if they're alive now, what would they think of this country now, you know? Would they think it was all worthwhile or how it's changed, you know?
and a very special time for you and so many other veterans.
Oh, yes, yes. When you go around and talk to them all, you know, and I don't know, it's fantastic, fantastic. And this will be probably the last one, I think, because let's face it, I'm 89 in a month's time, and most of these guys are well over the 80s and 90s, some of them.
Well, it's an absolute privilege to talk to you today and to see so many of the veterans here. Thank you for talking to me on BFBS.
Pleasure, thank you very much.
With me now is Ivan Cady, who was one of the Rangers involved in the D-Day landings. What are your memories of 70 years ago?
Well, I guess the closest thing would be to, like, you went to hell and back with all the blood and loose limbs and dead people and something unforgettable. It stays in your mind forever. And I guess I'm a survivor. And been trying to forget a lot of it for many years, but it still comes back. And just one of the lucky ones, I guess.
You're here with a lot of veterans who've come from America. You come from Minnesota. Was it important for you to come back for this commemoration?
This is the first time I've been back since the invasion, and got hooked up with what they call the greatest generation. It's out of Denver, Colorado, and they chose a few of us to come over here, and so I joined up with them.
We hear a lot about the weather on the night that the invasion took place. It wasn't the best seas. What was it like aboard the boats?
It was pretty nasty around there. A lot of wind, and the water was really cold. And you drop down, and it's all wet, and got sand all over you, which you can't get off of you. You hope you dodge all the bullets and all the artillery, and it's just unreal.
You were telling me that it was Omaha Beach that you landed on.
Omaha. The 5th Ranger Battalion was up down the beach from us, two of the 5th Ranger Battalion. And we had two companies that went up on Point Tahoe. It was 95 that made it up the cliffs. Big old pillbox up there in trenches. And they'd moved the artillery pieces. They'd moved them back to, I guess, some orchard or something. But they still had all the machine guns and small arms fire up there. So it's like a shooting gallery. Had lots of targets. Lots of memories.
In all the old familiar places that my heart and mind embraces all day through. In that small cafe, the park across the way, the children's carousel, chestnut tree, the wishing well, I'll be seeing you in every lovely summer's day, in everything that's light and gay. I'll always think of you that way. I'll find you in the morning sun, and when the night is blue, I'll be looking at the moon, but I'll be seeing you.
We're standing on the bridge of HMS Medusa, and Alan, it's been an amazing day with so many veterans coming aboard.
Yeah, it's quite something for us. It really reminds us why we do what we do. To see people of 90-odd come aboard here, suddenly shed 50 years, go striding around the vessel, up and down ladders as if they were youngsters, and leave with an enormous grin on their faces, it makes it all worthwhile.
And it's amazing to see the teamwork of the crew when you're under sail too.
Yeah, we've got an excellent team here. It's all volunteers. The whole volunteer group's about 50 people. Out of those, there's about 20 that actively sail with us, and at any time, 10 form the crew. We all know each other well, we work together well, just get on with it, and it's a real pleasure to operate this vessel.
A very important part of the restoration and also the continuation of HMS Medusa is the HMS Medusa Trust. How does that work?
Well, we set up the trust some years ago. The original owners of the vessel gifted the vessel to the trust. The whole purpose was to assure her future. So she's now owned and operated by the trust, the three trustees, And our whole purpose is to make sure this vessel stays together, looks good, stays operational, and can go around the place. Our thought is to take the vessel to the people rather than the other way around, so we're very much mobile.
70 years on, she looks absolutely amazing. What does the future hold for her?
Well, we want to keep her operational as long as we can, and that's going to be, we hope, decades into the future. We've got long-term plans for her because it's really important that this vessel, as the last of her class, is preserved permanently. In 100 years' time, she'll be sat alongside other important vessels we can see around us, like Warrior, Victory, Belfast up in London, Caroline over in Northern Ireland. She is one of the 20th century's vessel VIPs. We're putting our plans together at the moment for next year, which is to go back to Amsterdam. She was the first vessel there, arriving in Amsterdam round about Liberation Day, so we want to go back for VE Day.
What is it that makes her so special?
It's a difficult question to answer in a few words, but she is unique in that she is a small ship, and she handles like a small ship. She's operated like a big ship. There's nothing else like her. Everybody's used to the idea of going on a ship, throttles and gears and things on the bridge, and you just sort of waggle those and the ship goes where you want. Well, it's not quite like this on here. It's done by telegraphs to the engine room, and it's all about team operation. And one of the things we've done to help with our fundraising and going to be doing a lot more of is Team Building Day. We've rapidly discovered that if you put a team of people on here, they have to operate as a team for the vessel to operate. And that makes her pretty much unique. This is a good day for us. You have bad days when you're up to your armpits in cold water dealing with a pipe joint in a very awkward place, and you know, you wonder why you're doing it. When you see what the veterans get out of it and how much it means to them and the way they shake your hand when they leave, then you don't begrudge a second of the time.
Would you like to swing on a star, carry moonbeams home in a jar, and be better off than you are? Or would you rather be a mule? A mule is an animal with long, funny ears, kicks up at anything he hears.
His back is brawny, but his brain is weak. He's just plain stupid with a stubborn streak.
And by the way, if you hate to go to school, you may grow up to be a mule.
Or would you like to swing on a star, carry moonbeams home in a jar, and be better off than you are?
Or would you rather be a pig?
A pig is an animal with dirt on his face. His shoes are a terrible disgrace. He has no manners when he eats his food. He's fat and lazy and extremely rude.
But if you don't care a feather or a fig, you may grow up to be a pig.
Or would you like to swing on a star, carry moonbeams home in a jar, and be better off than you are?
Or would you rather be a fish?
A fish won't do anything but swim in a brook. He can't write his name or read a book. To fool the people is his only thought. And though he's slippery, he still gets caught.
But then if that sort of life is what you wish, you may grow up to be a fish. New kind of jumped up slippery fish, and all the monkeys aren't in the zoo.
Every day you meet quite a few.
So you see, it's all up to you. You can be better than you are. You could be swinging on a star.
You can't step on this ship without being affected by her. It happened to me 20 years ago, and I've been here ever since, and it's just a privilege to be on board.
Beautiful, absolutely beautiful. What they've done to it is just fantastic. We've come in, we've been on an inset day today, so we just came for a tour around the harbour, and the fact that we can go on this is just brilliant.
There is a gun behind you, and there's lots of people inside the boat.
And one old man we saw in his chair, and he went in there and he went all around the boat. I don't know how he managed it. It's quite incredible, actually. It's just brilliant to see these people still.
I think it's very interesting, yes, very good. It's very good condition.
Guns, toilets, engines, big, gigantic.
Very important for our heritage, absolutely.
You know, it's history, isn't it? It's living history.
How tiny it was, how cramped, and the thoughts of 22 people spending, I don't know, however many months they must have been on board. Having watched the programme about D-Day on television last night, it's brought it to home to me a bit.
And it's like when you're on a boat and it feels like it's moving.
Thinking of the history, well, men that could do that sort of thing, we were saying. The war is so emotional, isn't it?
The volunteers are looking after it. It's good that some people are prepared to spend the time to do it.
HMS Jews are brilliant!
Just you wait and see. I'll never forget the people I met braving those angry skies. I remember well as the shadows fell, the light of hope in their eyes. And though I'm far away, I still can hear them say, thumbs up. For when the dawn comes up, there'll be bluebirds over the white cliffs of Dover. Tomorrow, just you wait and see. There'll be love and laughter and peace ever after. Tomorrow, when the world is free, the shepherd will tend his sheep, the valley will bloom again, and Jimmy will go to sleep in his own little room again. There'll be bluebirds over the white cliffs of Dover tomorrow. Just you wait and see.
Digital radio, FM and satellite TV in the UK.
Online and on air. Around the world.
This is the Forces Station.
The FBS.